Good morning, everybody. It's Mark Steiner. Welcome back here to the Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. So this program today, as we've been doing every day, looking at this election of Donald Trump as the next president of the United States, what it means, where it comes from. We're talking about it from many different perspectives. And today, this is kind of brought to me by two pieces written by two men that I know who join us for this conversation. One was written by Dr. Bruce Perry, who's a retired professor of economics from UB, researcher in Chicago and political economy, a member of the Chicago Political Economy Group, who wrote a Marxist interpretation of this election. He's also a Vietnam veteran, graduated from West Point. And Bruce, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Very nice to be here, Mark. Good to talk to you.
And Bill Fletcher Jr. joins us. He wrote the other piece that we read that was really fascinating on this election. Bill Fletcher has been a guest on this program numerous times. His piece was written in the blackcommentator.com. Bill Fletcher Jr. is senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies. He's editorial member of blackcommentator.com, co-author of The Indispensable Ally, Black Workers, and the Formation of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, 1934 to 1941, and Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Towards Social Justice. And Bill, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Mark. Thanks for having me.
And Sabil Rahman is with us. Sabil Rahman is assistant professor of law, Brooklyn Law School, fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, New America, and author of Democracy Against Domination. And Sabil, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks, Mark.
And y'all can join us at 410-319-8888 by phone. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. I'll be checking those. And you can also send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. And you can also log into our Facebook pages, but do join us. Before we begin, I just want to make a short remembrance here. We lost someone yesterday, a shock to many of us, who did not know she was ill. We lost a friend and a colleague, I think a really top-notch journalist, an incredible human being, and just a lovely woman. Gwen Ifill passed away with cancer yesterday at 61 years old. The Ifills, they just turned out incredibly brilliant women like Sherilyn Ifill, her first cousin. They are just a great family. She was a wonderful human being. She was one of the few people, I think, in the world of journalism that really asked some tough questions and really had her nose to the grindstone with it all. Our heart breaks, our souls are sad. She was a brave woman who kept working through it all despite her cancer. And we just say rest well. And we'll always remember you and always talk about you and be inspired by your work. So, Gwen Ifill, farewell. Let me begin. There's so many questions here, and one of the questions that keeps coming up over and over again is Donald Trump's appeal to, we always say the working class. When we say the working class, we mean the white working class, but then that's also complex around this, the questions of class and race and the intersection of those in this election, and how we begin to parse those out in terms of what this really meant. Many people look at this as kind of a really, what this election was in many ways was a large critique of the neoliberal agenda from both sides of the fence. But there's so much complexity here, and people are going to be battling over race and class, what to find what in this election. And Bruce, this is your first time on the show in a long time. Let me let you begin.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, first of all, when we talk about the working class, we're talking about the multiracial working class. We're talking about all aspects of it. And it's very clear that Trump has appealed to the white section of the working class, and he's raised, you know, completely racist issues. But the key, I think, is some New York Times data that showed that people that feel they're better off, 72% of them voted for Hillary. But people that think they're worse off, 78% of them voted for Trump. And for people who think they're about the same over the last 4 years, the vote was completely divided. People were looking for change. And I think both the Bernie Sanders and the Donald Trump campaign indicated that very clearly. And Hillary represented, you know, stasis, status quo, no change, business as usual.
And Bill, how would you nuance that?
I think what we saw on Tuesday was a white revolt. I don't think it had very much to do with the working class. When you look at the actual numbers, voter turnout was down from the last two presidential election cycles. Trump did not get any significantly more voters than other Republican candidates. He touched a certain nerve, absolutely, but that nerve we have to really look at very, very carefully. That seemed to be a nerve that was much more among people who are not the principal victims of neoliberal globalization, but people that were white people that were very fearful of what's been happening in this country. And so in that sense, I would agree with the professor that people that thought, with an emphasis, thought that they were worse off were going to tend to vote for Trump. The question is, what was that thought? And part of the worse off for them was their fear of immigration, their fear of the changing demographics of this country. I mean, the whole notion, what appealed to the Trump voter is that this man was articulating this this racist, misogynist, xenophobic argument that we need to make America great again. And no one could really pin down when was this great period, but it seems to have been during the seasons of the Donna Reed Show.
I'm going to come back to the Donna Reed analysis here in a second, but Sabeel, let me let you leap into that.
Yeah, thanks. So, I mean, I definitely think there's an inescapable major component of racial dynamics and questions about gender and immigration for sure. But I want to pull back the lens a little bit from this particular election result. And, you know, there's a deep history of exactly this kind of battle between what we might think of as an exclusionary populism, you know, one that's been premised on a critique of unaccountable government and big corporations, but premised on a very narrow notion of who is a real true member of the people, right? And this is something you see in the Know-Nothings and going back into the 1800s, and in some ways has sort of taken a new form in this election. But we also have a tradition of more progressive populism as well, which takes on some of those same critiques about economic and political inequality, but in a much more inclusive way. And so I think the broader context for me of this election is sort of a battle between these two different ways of responding to a much wider sense of economic upheaval that we've been undergoing as a society.
So if you look at this election and look at the kind of the polls between Bernie Sanders and the poll, I mean, I'm talking about not the polls we take, but the between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump and the dissatisfaction the supporters of both showed in this country, that people are really reeling from the kind of neoliberal economic social policies that have taken place globally. And in part, that's what this erupted here. But I'm curious what that really means and how that shows any possibility of unity in any of this going forward when so much of it, it appears, is based around race, not just class. But clearly, there was this huge appeal, racist appeal in America. Let's take it one by one, the racist appeal that took place in this election. Why, you know, when you look at, electoral map, and that's a conversation in itself. Just what this electoral college really means, and its roots in slavery, which people seem to forget a great deal. But when you look at these maps they have, there's one map a nephew sent out to me the other day that showed that if you looked at this election through through race and class and the map itself, that if you took only the vote of white people in America and white men in America, the only two states that would have gone for Hillary Clinton were Oregon and Washington. And to me, Bill, I mean, that's part of the heart of this is we have to get to what this really means about who we are. I mean, and how we constantly have been in populist movements across our history divided by race.
Oh, there's no question about that. I mean, one thing, Mark, I think it's important. Hillary was unable to fully mobilize the so-called Obama coalition. And the issue there is that she was, simply put, the wrong candidate. She was not a credible candidate for an anti-corporate, anti-neoliberal agenda, even though it's important to acknowledge that she did shift to the left and the Democratic Party did shift to the left, but they did so because of the Bernie Sanders campaign. So I want to go back to what your earlier speaker was saying. I think that that's absolutely right, that there's a fight that takes place between right-wing populism and a more left or progressive populism. The left or progressive populism could be found in the Jesse Jackson campaigns of the 1980s, as well as the Sanders campaign. The problem, though, with the Sanders campaign and analysis, and it was reflected again in his New York Times op-ed on Saturday, is that he doesn't fully understand the race dynamic. So when in describing Trump's victory as a matter of Trump tapping into the legitimate fears and concerns of the people, first of all, that just doesn't conform to the numbers, but it's also just simply a wrong analysis of what's really going on out there. There is tremendous fear among large sections of the white population that the American dream is moving out of their grasp, in part because of the changing demographics. There's just tremendous fear, and Trump was able to play to it.
So, because if you look at this, you know, when we talk about the working class in America and how people vote, Bruce, I mean, so if you look at Baltimore, Baltimore is as much a Rust Belt city as Detroit or any other city in America. But Baltimore, because it is not a majority white city, went for Hillary Clinton, as the most cities. Rust Belts that were primarily white went for Donald Trump. I mean, this divide is so deep. The question is, I mean, how does that define this election? How does it divide what may be going ahead within both parties in the future and what the future might be?
I think that we're in a fundamentally different period than we have been in other third-party runs. I think that when we look at what's actually happening, we're seeing that the economy is actually destabilizing the political situation. While offshoring is part of that, technology and technological change is actually responsible for about 88% of the job loss. And we're seeing towns like Baltimore, but also like Youngstown, Ohio. The Guardian did a very good analysis during the election of Youngstown, Ohio, which was split between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. And they basically said everybody here is on one side or the other. That destabilization economic destabilization is fundamental to the political destabilization that we're seeing. And I think that we're in a new period where the polarity between these two wings is growing. It therefore is beholden to progressives and those who really want to fight for a new society to work within the working class and win them over to a correct position. Bernie Sanders was a New Deal Democrat. He's not particularly he did three things that were fundamental. He raised the question of socialism. He pointed the finger at the 1%, and he pointed out that the Democrats and Republicans are bought for and paid for by that 1%. The left has been trying to do that for years, and he did that. He gave us an opportunity to work within that motion, and we need to continue that and build independent political organizations. When I say independent, I mean independent of the corporations and independent of the Democratic and Republican parties.
Mr. Sabiel, how do you see? Respond to the last two our last two speakers, Bill and Bruce.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I agree that I think this is a really a difficult challenge, and it's one that we've been faced with repeatedly in our history of how to get over the deep racial divide, even when there are sort of economic challenges on that are more widely shared. I'd say two things just to kind of. That I am focusing on to give us some optimism in the midst of everything. I think one is that I think it's in addition to what Bruce was saying about the Sanders campaign, which I think did put some really important issues on the Democratic Party's map in terms of foregrounding the critique of corporate power, of political corruption. Right, these are central aspects to any progressive populism that have to be dealt with and will have to be addressed. But the other thing that I think is really important and interesting to look forward to is that if you look at the many of the movements among the multiracial working class, right, whether it's, a lot of the working class is very much mostly communities of color, right, if you look at it more broadly. And what's interesting is if you look at a lot of the community organizations working in these spaces, many of their critiques of the economy are very much structural. It's they're advancing critiques that could have implications for all of us across racial lines. So, for example, rebuilding the safety net, doing something about the financialization of the economy and the rise of sort of return of monopoly corporate concentration, which is skewing the economy for all of us. And so I do think there are glimmers where we could build a more universal economic reconstruction that takes seriously the questions of racial exclusion from our history, but would actually, in fact, work for all of us.
So, you know, when you look around the country, Bill, there it's here in Baltimore, where there, I would say, there are not just hundreds but thousands of people gathering in this city, literally thousands, in different meetings, talking about how to develop this movement against Trump and what's happened in America, but also about the city itself. And you see that, and it's a multiracial movement. The working class elements are clearly from the Black community and Latino communities in the city for the most part. So I mean, this is happening across America, I think. So what role does that play? I mean, these are folks who are not Democratic Party insiders. These are folks on the outside of that structure for the most part. And there's something else going on the inside that may be splitting and battling inside the Democratic Party itself. So what does that dynamic take us?
Well, I think that there's a number of interesting possibilities. So one that you mentioned, there is a struggle going on in the Democratic Party right now, and part of it is over the question of leadership and whether Congressman Keith Ellison will emerge as the new chair of the Democratic National Committee, which is certainly my hope.
Why is that your hope? Talk about why that would make a difference from your perspective.
He has been one of the main leaders of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. He has been very outspoken in his politics. He's a Sanders supporter. I think that he understands the direction the Democratic Party needs to go and is someone that's oriented towards the grassroots. So within the Democratic Party, we need that type of leadership. We also need grassroots organizations that are prepared to work both inside and outside of the Democratic Party. And I think that that's part of what we are seeing now. It was certainly the legacy of the Sanders campaign, which was one of the most successful insurgencies within the Democratic Party in years. So all of that, I think, is very, very important. The cautionary note, again, is that unless race is dealt with, we will find that the new majority that actually is coming into being in this country will fragment. And that's why I'm saying that we need, let's say, Sanders plus, that his arguments around economic populism tend to be race neutral. And the problem is that doesn't relate to the history of the United States. If you're not addressing race, we have a problem. As you know, Mark, I've been very active in the labor movement. And one of the big challenges in the labor movement has been this reticence to address race.
Right.
As a result, you know, right-wing populism has permeated our ranks, and in the exit polls indicate that about 51% of union families voted for Hillary, and that's down significantly from usually well above 60%. And I think that relates to not having these kinds of discussions about race and class within our ranks.
And I think, I'm going to start with the Democratic Party aspect of what you said and go to Bruce, but I want to come back to the last thing you said here, because it also shows if 51% of the working class, of that percentage, holds up in the analysis, that means that the majority of white members of the working class voted for Trump, probably the majority of non-white working class people in this country voted for Hillary or didn't vote.
I think the data shows that, you know, the majority of the white section of the working class the white males voted for Trump, but it also shows that white women who were not college graduates, 53% voted for Trump, and the split of college graduate women was about even. I think that the question of race has to be raised. That has to be raised with the white workers. We've got to work among the white workers. The left is particularly weak among the white section of the working class, and if we let that go, that's the basis of a fascist front for the right wing. We've got to work. I mean, among that section of the working class, it's decisive.
Which is why it's not so far-fetched, Sybil, to talk about when people use the word fascism, talking about Donald Trump's victory, is not something that is, you know, just some people think it's just sloganeering, name-calling, but there's a real autocratic strain and possibility here, and this could be the beginnings of it.
Well, I think that's a real possibility, and I think, first of all, fascism is a class dictatorship of the capitalist, a decision of the capitalist class, not of an individual, but the individual affects it. And Trump is clearly moving in that direction. The police state, the apparatus of the police state, is firmly in place. I mean, and I think that the capitalist class believe that the motion of the workers is more advanced than the left and the revolutionaries and the progressives believe.
Sybil, you were saying what?
Yeah, I would slightly differ. Authoritarianism.
This is Bill, right?
Authoritarianism. Oh,
right.
This is Bill.
I'm sorry, Bill. We'll get you in Sybil in 1 second. Go ahead, Bill.
Right-wing authoritarianism takes many different forms. Military coup d'etats, repressive regimes, as well as fascism. So what is unique about fascism is that it's not a conservative movement. It's very radical. And I don't mean radical in a left-wing sense. I mean radical in a sense that it seeks the elimination of any semblance of so-called democratic capitalism. Mm-hmm. It is completely, it's a lawless system. And it is certainly rooted among many of the population, much of the population that actually voted for Trump. That's often the social base for it. But the fact that Trump is authoritarian does not necessarily mean that we're on the verge of fascism. There are other equally dangerous possibilities. And one is a slower moving authoritarianism where the semblance of democracy continues to exist, but the parameters become increasingly narrowed. And it's in that situation that many people, you know, to borrow from the story of the man who jumped off the Empire State Building, and when he was passing the 40th floor, he was overheard saying, "So far, so good." there's an element of that that happens when you have this kind of slow-moving repression where people say, well, it's not that bad, it's not that bad, there are no concentration camps, it's not that bad. And people can get lulled into a false sense of security. So I think we have to understand this country is definitely under Trump. The ruling group, the Trump administration, is taking us in an authoritarian direction. And one thing is also clear is that he has no problem playing patty cake with neo-fascists and secessionists.
We have to take a short break and we'll come right back to Sybil Rahman. Sorry we didn't get right to it for a break, Sybil. But do join us here at 410-319-8888. We want to hear your thoughts and voices here on The Mark Steiner Show, or tweet us at Mark Steiner. Email us at talk@steinershow.org, 410-319-8888. We'll get your calls in this last half hour of the first hour of the program, and we'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner here with Bill Fletcher, Bruce Perry, and Sybil Rahman, and you at 410-319-8888. Sybil, I'm sorry we didn't get to you before break. Jump in.
Really quickly, before the break, we were talking about sort of some of the deep concerns, right, about creeping authoritarian tendencies. I mean, I think, as a lawyer, one of the things that I think I definitely agree is has been alarming this campaign is the frontal attack in terms, at least as a matter of rhetoric so far, right, on some of our basic constitutional precepts, right? Our whole country is founded on the idea of checks and balances and the separation of powers and elections and federalism and basic individual rights and civil liberties. And these are all things that sort of came under verbal attack over the course of the campaign. I think that's really worrying. But I also think that in addition to what Bruce and Bill were saying, that there is a sort of a longer sense of kind of an erosion or a hollowing out of our faith in our democratic institutions that predates this election and in some ways made us vulnerable to some of these kinds of appeals that we saw in this campaign. You know, if people lose faith that institutions are in fact accountable and responsive and representative, then it's much easier to sort of envision an appeal to a kind of singular individual who's going to sweep away all the corruption and sort of govern through kind of individual power. So there's a much deeper challenge here in terms of restoring our democratic institutions that goes beyond this particular election and campaign.
I mean, but clearly the things that this administration could do, and you're going to see all the Republicans that did not support in the corporate class who did not support Donald Trump circle around him, I think, at this point, and to try to control what's going on. And that'll be part of their own internal struggle, I think, once they have this White House. But you're also going to see them do some things with the Supreme Court justices being put in, with what they may do in terms of immigration and rounding people up, with what they may do. But, you know, I thought about this morning as I woke up. I was thinking, we've seen the last, whatever that number is now, 8 years of the Black Lives Matter movement that's exploding across America. What won here was Blue Lives Matter, not Black Lives Matter. So all this, right. I mean, you know, Bill, all this to me portends some really rocky roads ahead. And I think we're being lulled at the moment by everybody playing nice, and this is democratic transition, everything's fine, you know, but it's not.
it's not. And Harry Reid was exceptionally good in calling it as it was. And my hat goes off to him, because while Hillary made her, you know, diplomatic concession, and Obama is trying to lead us to believe that it's really not as bad as it is, Harry Reid was very clear that this election emboldened the racists, the misogynists, the xenophobes, and the kinds of attacks that we have to expect are exactly what Professor Rahman was laying out. We should expect immediately after the inauguration attacks on immigrants. We're dealing with a president who, by all reports, is very vengeful, and therefore may come after various political opponents. And the other thing we have to understand is that what we're witnessing in Trump is part of a global phenomena of the growth of right-wing populism. The specter that is haunting the world now is a specter of right-wing populism. And these sort of irrationalist, nationalist, repressive, very pro-capitalist regimes that see in each other soul brothers and soul sisters.
And Bruce, I mean, that is part of the reality you were talking about earlier. And that's, I mean, you heard the President Obama's today in Greece and the Awakening Dawn Party, one of those two ways, you know, very clear about this election to them, bolsters them as it bolsters the move in Austria, France, Britain, elsewhere.
Yes, but we're also seeing the rise of left-wing populism, and the polarity is developing, and it's developing, I think, because of the underlying economic basis and the politics. It's our turn. It's our time to go out and to do this. Is exactly what we have talked about for years. It's our time to go out and to organize and to build a left progressive populism. Obviously, the capitalist class, the corporations, and their representatives are going to do what they're going to do. Politics of the capitalist class is going to continue to move to the right. It may not move in a straight line, but it's going to continue to move to the right. Our job is to build a working class political power, an actual political power that's independent of that capitalist class. And, you know, the next step to me in doing that is to create a third party that's independent of the Democrats and the Republicans and the corporations. And we have to do that by building our own organizations and by working within the Democratic Party to split off that left wing that Bernie Sanders mobilized.
So what role does the Democratic Party play in all this, do we think, Sabeel?
Well, I think there's a way in which the kind of mainstream liberal consensus for the last, say, you know, 20-odd years has been a little slow to come to terms with some of these deeper problems, right, in the economy that both Bruce and Bill have been talking about. And I think that's something that, you know, the party will have to grapple with, right? In the 90s and even in during the Obama administration, there were a lot of ways in which, whether it's financial reform or other issues, where the party sort of stopped short of something more robust and aggressive and transformational. And in a way, that kind of came back to haunt the party in this election. I think more broadly, there are some questions about, you know, how do you make a party that has some of the features that Bruce and Bill were talking about, where there is actual on-the-ground grassroots organizations rooted in communities. It's not just about an election every 4 years and, you know, get out the vote.
So do all of you think that if you were, say, you know, there's one of these debates in here about leading up to elections between people on this program about third parties and backing third parties, not backing third parties, voting for Hillary, not voting for Hillary, how you deal with Donald Trump and more. But the reality is that third parties in America, the third parties in America at this moment, really amount to nothing. And that might really upset some of the people who listen to this show, but they amount to nothing. Jill Stein got 1%, barely, and kind of had a kind of very insular view of the world, and it did not appeal to masses of people at all. So the people who might have voted for Green or might have voted for the left actually didn't vote. 10 million fewer votes for Hillary Clinton than in 2008 for Barack Obama. So that, and with Keith Ellison becoming head of the Democratic Party, potentially, as their chairman, and, you know, he's a very progressive guy and African-American and Muslim. You know, I'm wondering, what do you think we're setting up here?
So, Mark, if I could just jump in on that really quick. I mean, we have a very recent example of a pretty major party realignment, and that's after Obama became president with the Tea Party and its tremendous influence on the Republican Party's, you know, accelerated shift to the right. That was a sort of third party within a party kind of move, right? And so I think that's instructive for progressives who are trying to think about, you know, how do we build that sort of broader progressive argument that I think all of us are hoping for, but do it in a way that actually builds political influence and political power in the short and long run.
You're about to say what, Bruce?
I think, that there is a battle. I hope Keith Ellison becomes the head of the Democratic Party. The battle is, a battle is going to be fought out within the Democratic Party over what direction to go. However, I also think that we are in a different period. We are in a period that of political realignment where both parties are splitting, and that we're going to see the emergence of something different. It isn't the same old third-party run that we have seen in the past. I agree with your assessment of Jill Stein and the Green Party run on this election. They basically failed to fill the vacuum left by the Bernie meltdown at the end. I mean, they had an opportunity. That didn't happen. We have to continue to build a third party that's real. And if there is a political realignment that's occurring, it will not be the kind of third party run we've seen in the past. It'll be a viable national party.
Well, I mean, you can see that Bill, I mean, there are, just aside, before we go right back to you, Bill Fletcher, you can see inside the Greens themselves right now, as small as they are, there's a giant split in there being led by Rosa Clemente and others saying that the Greens are no longer the alternative because they don't listen to black folks or people who aren't white, and there's a whole battle inside that going on there right now. But you're about to say what, Bill? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I actually think that that's the least of their problems. they basically showed themselves to be irrelevant. And yeah. One of the worst things is not to be condemned because people disagree with you, but to be condemned for being irrelevant. This is a party that has spent precious little time developing a national strategy for building the party and building its influence. They have made a principle of being independent of the Democratic Party. So that's meant that there's a whole set of alliances they simply cannot entertain. So there's a lack of a strategic vision that is substituted with ideological platitudes. I think that the building of an independent force really needs to take place in multiple levels. And part of the problem, Mark, is that much of the progressive movement thinks about the notion of building a third party as, let's call a convention. You know, let's call a convention and bring all of the alienated together, and we'll come up with a platform and boom. As opposed to the very patient work that's necessary on multiple levels. I mean, when Sabeel mentioned the issue of the Tea Party, let's keep in mind that what the Tea Party did was actually not very different from what Jesse Jackson did in the 80s with the Rainbow.
Right.
The difference is that the Tea Party was much more diverse, not only ethnically or racially, but diverse organizationally. It wasn't dependent on one person. But the idea of these insurgencies within the parties, I think, makes perfect sense. It's definitely the way that things could go. I would suggest, though, so very specifically, that we need to develop a progressive approach state by state that really looks at a strategy for winning power within those states. Because it's not just the fixation on presidential elections. We really need to be concerned with what's happening at the state level, in part because one aspect of the right-wing strategy is to accumulate enough states such that they can call a constitutional convention and change the U.S. Constitution. And they're somewhere between 6 and 8 states away from having that number. So the whole fight at the level of winning governorships and state legislatures is so essential. But many of us only engage in politics every 4 years.
That's a really important point, if I could just jump on.
Sabeel Rahman, go ahead.
Yeah, and so, you know, I think there's a progressives sort of tend to focus on the national, in part because, you know, the intellectual tradition of progressivism since FDR has very much been about the federal government, right? Since FDR and civil rights, but you know, the state and local is critical. And the other thing I'll add, not just the constitutional amendments piece, but also redistricting, right? We forget sometimes that, you know, in part because of the Tea Party wave in 2010. Republicans were in control of many state houses at the moment of the 10-year redistricting cycle, which meant that, you know, since then, even when Democrats have pulled even or even slightly ahead in the popular vote for the House, they have pretty far behind in terms of actual seats. Now, the next redistricting cycle is of course, coming up in 2020, and it just sort of redoubles the importance of state governments as part of a broader long-term progressive agenda.
You know, I think that the question of how you organize and organizing this, I'm curious what our listeners think at 410-319-8888 and where you are with all of this. I mean, this is really, most people are not going to spend their days and lives and hours and energy organizing, but people who have been active politically will, and maybe. And the question is, what form does that take? I mean, I was thinking about, again, when what you said earlier, Bruce, about people who are white and working class in America, and the left doesn't have any idea how to appeal to them, or it's not appealing at all, not working at all there. But, you know, yeah. When you look at things in the past, that for any dent to take place, that took some hardcore organizing, either as unions that were doing in common struggle with everybody in one union, or you were seeing people organizing in poor neighborhoods and trying to bring those neighborhoods together, which I and many others did in the past. And so, you know, I mean, but so what form does that take, given that race is now so, is at the fore of the political struggle in America in ways it has not really been, I think, ever, in terms of understanding the depth of that. And that's not, and that is such a deep divide. Organizing around with that in that segment is no easy trick.
No, it isn't. And, you know, we don't have the union movement, the broad union movement that we've had in the past. The situation has changed. And we do have to focus on community organizing, community-based organizing. And, you're right. We have to bring race to the forefront and point out to the white worker while working in white communities that racism hurts them. The attack is on the black worker, but and other minorities, but the effect is to isolate the white worker. And we've got to point that out and point out that the strength comes from unity.
Bill, as an old union guy, leap in.
You see, it seems to me we actually do know what to do. But that there's a combination of cowardice as well as issues of resources. That what we need to do is engage people in actual struggles, real campaigns, combining that with education of the activist core, so that people are able to construct a broader framework in order to get reality and figure out what to do. I mean, we know this. It really isn't rocket science. It's hard, but it's not rocket science. And so earlier, Sabir was mentioning certain kinds of campaigns that need to be undertaken. And we need to be thinking at that level. I mean, for example, we're going to be losing, more than likely, the Affordable Care Act or a significant part of it. Well, there's a number of us that have for years talked about single payer. Well, we need to reconstruct that that coalition. And we need to be deploying people that are organizing in communities and workplaces around around this issue. There's multiple issues that need to be taken up. The issue of the police and law enforcement. I mean, my goodness, this is a discussion that we absolutely have to have within white communities. So we know a lot of this, but it's easier to avoid the question. It's easier to say, well, let's just pick an issue that everybody agrees on, and we're not going to talk about race, and that will unify us. It doesn't work that way. So I do think, I mean, that's why I'm actually optimistic, because I believe that there are very clear steps that can be undertaken, Mark.
You know, when you think about this, a couple of things you mentioned here, one was the single pay, the question of health care. Clearly that that Trump and the Republicans are going to dismantle the what we call Obamacare, the Affordable Health Care Act. And many of us, as we analyze this thing and have this show's been covering this since the Clinton effort around health care reform in the 90s till now. And there are so many people who have called for single payer. I mean, this is, and with if Ellison does in fact become chairman of the party, the Democratic Party we're talking about, then this seems to be an opportunity for he, Sanders, Warren, Elijah Cummings, numbers of people I could talk about, to kind of push the idea popularly in communities and in Congress. Well, you want to dismantle Obamacare? Single payer is the way we need to do it, as making that a part of the national discussion, and that I think is what. That's what it will take.
Agree.
The other thing I'll just add quickly, Mark, is that you know, we've been talking a lot in terms of the Democratic Party, but you know, both Bruce and Bill also pointed to the importance of independent sort of community organizing, and you know, in a lot of our states and cities, there are some really great community organizers who have been doing this work, you know, for a long time, and I think you know, people feel mobilized to get involved. You know, they're that's also a way to do it. I mean, it takes resources and you know, and a lot of kind of elbow grease, right? But we need to sort of be investing in that part of our broader sort of civic and movement life as well. You know, not just the party strategy.
And when you talk about the police, now if we have Rudy Giuliani as the next Attorney General, which some people are speculating. There's just a consent decree here in Baltimore. Consent decrees were all over the country with police departments around brutality and racism. Those could all be put way on the back burner by this administration, which puts the reform of that and the control of that and the battle around how to change the nature of public safety and communities inside the communities themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're going to get no help. There'll be no intervening AG's office coming in saying we're going to do an investigation. That's over.
Correct.
Yeah, that's right.
No, that's correct. And that will make the fight for local political power that much more important. And really taking on some very deep structural changes that will need to take place in law enforcement that many people have shied away from. And for understandable reasons, because it is very, very difficult. But it's going to make that local fight and the statewide fights that much more important.
You're about to say what, Bruce?
I was about to say similar things, that the fight for jobs, health care, police brutality, and education are the central struggles within the communities today. And they're going to be ignored, by the administration, and it's going to come down to the local efforts to unify communities in the struggle, because I think Bill was absolutely right. It's within the struggle that these lessons can be learned, that unity is the key to victory.
Now, I may be getting super paranoid, which is possible once in a while, but when you look... except for Maryland, almost all the FOPs in America endorse Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The majority of people who are in this new military of ours, the non-draft military, well, it's not so new, but the non-draft military, voted for Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And there are scores of highly armed, mostly white militias all across America. And when I said earlier that Black Lives Matter was the movement that's pushed forward a lot in the last several years, and that is the guy who I'm forgetting who may end up being head of Department of Homeland Security, the African-American sheriff from Milwaukee, I think, led the chant Blue Lives Matter, and that's what has to win this election. So what role does that play? I mean, you said earlier, you know, Bruce, that all the apparatus for a police state are in place. And
they absolutely are.
Right.
And I think that, and I don't think you're paranoid, or just because you're paranoid, doesn't mean they aren't out there, right? And it's going to be a vicious fight. I know the fight here in Chicago over merely saying Black Lives Matter has created, a violent reaction from the, we have Blue Lives Matter and we have police within the community that just react, with violence against us, and the force is on their side. But we have, we have to face the reality that stuff is moving, that entire apparatus is moving to the right and is going to continue on, and we have to use our power within the community to actually, build unity and to fight that kind of force and apparatus.
Bill, and then Sabeel.
I don't think you're paranoid either, but I would say that the police, just while the FOP backed Trump, there was that statement that shocked many people by the police chiefs that said that the police owed people of color an apology for the history of the relations of the police to people of color, which I was stunned by. I think that we have to look at the situation. This is very complicated because the right-wing populists have an armed wing, which you were referring to. And as I like to say, it's not just like arms with 45 caliber or shotguns. You're talking about people with rocket-propelled grenades, grenade mm-hmm. launchers, machine guns, etc., who are looking forward to an Armageddon. And so you do have that. The formal... police and military is a bit more divided about how to deal with that element. And that's a division that is in our interest to ensure continues. We do not want to have a situation where the police start to come to rely on these militias to carry out extrajudicial killings. And so I think that trying to drive wedges there is going to be very, very important. And this is why we're now really in a battle for democracy. And I think that we need to frame the struggle that we're undertaking as just that.
So I'm going to go to the phones. I want to apologize to my listeners here, all the people who called in. The screen is not working on our computer here in the studio, and I had no idea that we had a full bank of calls, people waiting to get in this conversation. My deep apologies to my listeners for not knowing that you were there waiting to get on the air. But let's try to get some of you in right now. Lolita, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I become speechless. But I think what I wanted to comment on was like 10,000 comments way back when. I feel like I may be expressing some of the sentiments of your callers. I'm not amazed. This fashion has always existed in America. It's never been dealt with. The neocons have always been in place in Washington. They're finally getting their day. But my question that I wanted to ask or what I wanted to throw out and ask you to comment on was, how has 9/11 and the subsequent wars that we've been involved in, the escalation of terrorism around the world, particularly in Europe, has fueled all this right-wing movement? And also how that has drained the economies of many nations because of this fight or this endless war that was started by Bush. So that's what I would like you to comment on. And how has that played into this shift? Because I feel like this shift has been planned probably 50 years ago. And now we're just starting to see the fruition of what has been put in motion. So I would take my comment off air.
Sure, thanks so much. Let's try to get a quick thought on that. Sabeel, you want to jump in?
I'd be curious what Bruce and Bill also have to say about this. I mean, I think certainly these are all related in a lot of ways. I mean, I think there's, I'd say two things. I mean, one is that, you know, there is there's been an ongoing kind of response or backlash to the kind of catastrophic interventions in parts of the Middle East that mixed it on both left and right. But I think that, you know, there's a way in which some of the responses in terms of, you know, Islamophobia after 9/11 and has been very similar to a lot of the increase in harassment and hate crimes that we're seeing today. And so, you know, there's a lot of parallels. These have definitely been building off of one another in some ways.
And I think that the right has really, you know, seized 9/11 and used it to their own advantage, you know, and capitalism tends to generate war, and it has done that continually since 9/11. But one of the things that the left needs to do, the progressives need to do, is to learn to seize galvanizing events and use them the way the right does it very effectively. We need to use those galvanizing events like 9/11 for a progressive to build a progressive agenda within the community.
A quick closing thought, Bill Fletcher, and
9/11 burst the bubble that surrounded much of this country, and particularly white America, where people thought that we were impervious to what was happening on the rest of the planet. And ever since then, the fear and the fears that domestically exist of people of color, and particularly of black folks, and the fears of the external environment have enveloped this country and led to a very firm foundation for irrationalism. And that's what we got to appreciate, that the fears that people have, for example, of terrorism, are so out of proportion to the actual danger, but they are in some ways, that's what people are grappling onto, because they represent the fears of a changing world.
Well, gentlemen, this was a wonderful conversation. Again, my apologies to our listeners. The screen was not working. I didn't know all of you had called in, but if you can hold on and jump into our next segment, we're about to talk to several artists in the new exhibition about this very issue in our city here and around the country from an artistic perspective. But let me thank my guests first, Bill Fletcher Jr., Sabil Rahman, and Dr. Bruce Perry. We'll be linking to the articles and the thoughts of our guests here on our Facebook page, on our webpage at steinershow.org. So Bill, Sabil, Bruce, thank you three so much.
Thank
for joining
you.
Us.
Thank you, Mark, for having me.
And thank you all for calling in. We'll get you next hour. I'll be watching.